This is the podcast recording for Physics 2710, Intro to Modern Physics, 31st of January 2007. I brought the books that I mentioned last time. I thought you might enjoy just taking a quick sneak peek at the covers. So Marty's going to
show them to you. Barnes & Noble's.
Oh, really?
Seen them several times, yeah. I didn't know if they were for reals or jokes or what. That, and I didn't have money to buy them.
There's the physics of Star Trek. And this guy's a genuine physicist. He's become actually quite well-known as a popularizer of science. They always interview him on the TV talk show things nowadays. And it's a fun book. If you like Star Trek, I think you'd enjoy that. And then this is the philosophical version that asks, you know, if you're the same person, if you change all your atoms out for some identical atoms, are you still the same person? It's very interesting also if you like philosophy. They're both good books, but of course they're not required reading for the course.
But I could read one for my Cosmos class, couldn't I?
Is there an assignment to read a book in Cosmos? Oh.
And I have to do a little synopsis of it.
The Contact movie?
Yeah, Contact. Yeah. By Carl Sagan.
Yeah. Well, that's a different book. It's a good one, too.
Yeah, I've read that one, too.
You've read everything. Okay, questions. How did the homework go on the partial derivatives, Deb?
Got it. I'm so excited.
Okay. 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 Teresa, did you have any...
Did you get my homework? I mean, I just hope it's correct, I guess.
But you think it's correct, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. That problem, that made sense to me.
Okay. Zergut. Miles.
Yes.
I answered your question about conservation of angular momentum.
I read it.
Did it make sense?
I glanced over it. I'm going to read it today.
Okay. He was asking about the equation on page 126.
It had the feel of making sense. How about that?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, you were making notes in your book. Let's finish up the answer then. Page 126, 3/4 of the way down. I answered this over email. Jacob's got notation in his book about the right side being MVR for a particle moving in a straight line with respect to an axis of computation for your angular momentum. The left side was the question, and that's another way of writing the angular momentum is I omega, I being the rotational inertia, and then omega. And actually, d phi dt is omega, and mr squared is the moment of inertia around the axis for the point.
Okay, wait,
moving
slow
along.
Down. What are you looking at again? Page 126.
That's the equation. So,
where's the 126? All right, that makes sense now.
I got
it. L is the angular momentum, and it's defined as this cross product in one way of thinking about it. And so if you have some kind of axis that you're computing your moment of inertia around, it's probably easier to think of things going around in a circle, so do that first. And then that would be your R vector, and that might be your P vector, and you cross product those, and that gives you, with the right-hand rule, R cross P is out of the page, into the camera, the L. But for a single particle, that's its P would be MV. It turns out this all ends up for the simple case as MVR in magnitude. It's not a vector anymore. You could still put a vector over the V, but I guess the important point to realize is that when you discuss angular momentum in a physics class, you almost always do it in terms of something going around a circular orbit, but there's no reason it has to be that way. You can keep this same center of what used to be the center of the circle, the center of rotation, only the object doesn't have to be rotating. It might just be going by in a straight line. At that point, it still has the same R, and it still has the same MV, which is the momentum. So it's still the same answer. What's remarkable is it's still the same answer when it's here and when it's here. than when it's here. It doesn't matter where on that straight line it is. R will change. That's the new R, or that's the newer R. That's okay. Those are different R's. But when you cross it with P, you will still get exactly the same total final answer. So you can talk about the angular momentum of an object that's moving in a straight line if you specify what point you're computing the angular momentum about, and we have done that. So this is all legal. In terms of that scattering experiment that we're looking at, the picture is on page 127 at the top, or I think there's some other pictures, maybe 123 at the top, shows that there's a dotted straight line of showing where it would go if it hadn't been scattered. That's this line I've drawn right here, and the distance from that to the point you're computing it around, the scattering nucleus, is now not called R, but it's called B, the impact parameter. So that's where we get the left side of this equation. Right side. So it's on the right side of the equation we just talked about. Now, the other way to talk about angular momentum, which is not really different, but it just uses different symbols, is L equals I omega, where this is the moment of inertia or the rotational inertia, and this is the angular velocity in radians per second. The units still work out and still give you units of angular momentum. Everything works out cool. For a particle around a point, if you have a point, an axis that you're computing, and you first want to do it in a circle, but we're going to skip that step this time, and then do it for a straight line with an impact parameter B, this particle has all of its mass concentrated right there relative to this thing. So it's all one little particle. It's not a spread out thing that we need to use those fractions and all that stuff for the eyes for. The moment of inertia of this particle is simply mb squared, or r in this case. I guess r is the one they write in the book. R squared. And omega is change in angle, only they've called the angle phi this time. That's the whole deal. That's now the left side of the equation. And they're simply saying that conservation of angular momentum has to apply at every instant. So this is always going to be true. And they use that to derive some other stuff. Any questions?
Not yet.
Okay. We talked about models of the atom last time. Classical model, let's skip the Thomson pudding model. Did that already. Let's maybe even skip the solar system model of Rutherford and jump right back in where we were with the Bohr model. Please refresh my memory about the Bohr model.
Well, you made certain assumptions. You talked about the stationary states existing in atoms, so the electrons can only exist in states. I don't know how else to describe it.
Yep. Great. Yeah, that's fine. Why isn't this a classical model?
Because it deals with that the idea of quantization.
Right. That these electrons cannot exist in orbits between those stationary states that have specific energies. Therefore, your electron can't have any old energy you want it to. It has a few restricted choices, whatever those allowed orbits are. It's going to have allowed sizes, or the radius of the orbit's going to be quantized, and the energy will correspond. So it's not classical in that you don't get any value of energy you want to. How does this relate to light?
The energy that it has to use to move from one state to another is given off as light, and the frequency of the light is dependent on that amount of energy.
Exactly. And it is quantized by the same parameter that always quantizes things, namely h. So the energy of the light is h times the frequency, and that energy is determined by, as Deb said, the gap between those two allowed stationary states, whatever ones they might be. There might be lots of states, and you can jump from any one to any other one, but there's going to be a specific amount of energy that corresponds to that. Okay. We're going to hit here soon on the troubles with the Bohr model, but we better first be impressed with its successes. and that it really does work well. And so maybe this is the time to watch the video. Bohr's model is extremely successful, and how do we know this? Because it matches experimental evidence that we can take. We can make these spectral line measurements very accurately, remarkably so, and the Bohr model works out fine. Now, the book does mention, if I can find it again, that page 139, there were a few little issues. The assumption that Bohr started with was that the nucleus was infinitely massive, and so it didn't move, and that's not quite true. It's just quite massive, 2,000 times more massive than the electron. But really, they both move around each other, around their center of mass. So you make that correction, and then you do very, very well, extremely well. They also mention on the top of the next page, 140, that you can apply this to these other Rydberg-type atoms, which have one electron going around some stuff in down below. Maybe it's even doubly ionized, like you might have a helium that's ionized or a lithium double ionized, so that it looks kind of like a hydrogen atom, except it's got more charge in there than just one. You've got one electron, but now you might have two or three protons pulling on it. However, that works out pretty well too if you just multiply everything by that charge squared, the z squared. So each one of those is exerting an attractive force on the electron. So the Bohr model just does really, really well. What are its limitations? You supply those for me. You can read them off page 141. Teresa, we haven't heard from you today, so talk to us about the limitations.
Well, it seems like the main limitation was is that it was only really successful on single electron atoms.
Right.
And it couldn't, something about fine lines, when they made finer grids and looked at the fine line, it couldn't totally predict that.
Right. And the third one it lists there on page 141 that doesn't really tell us much about molecules.
No. Okay, molecules. Yep.
Okay, good. So successful as it was, again, it's a stepping stone to where we're really headed. And we'll spend a significant amount of time in chapter 6, I think it's 6, doing some more of the hydrogen atom. 7. 7 is the hydrogen atom. And we'll try to do it right then. That's where the differential equations is. Miles is all excited.
Oh, no, I don't remember how to do that.
It's nice to have a math major in here. We don't get too many of those.
I think you guys know better than I do. Is that doing it now?
I am.
No, I took it when you did.
Oh, yeah. Let's see, what is that?
Uh-huh. How long ago was differential equations?
A year ago.
Oh, that's fresh. Teresa, how long ago was differential equations?
Like 20.
And there is kind of a shelf life for math knowledge. It kind of tends to go away and let, but I think it can come back surely quicker the second time than when you learned it the first time. So anyway, we'll do some of that in chapter 7. Let's talk about section 4.6, which begins on page 141. And these X-ray spectra and how they come about with Moseley's experiment and data. And then we have the Frank Hertz experiment, and that's it for chapter 4. Maybe we should make sure we're catching up on everything. Let's go to the computer and we'll go through these notes and get a running start at where we are now. Yeah, we're doing better and better. Classical pictures on the top. This is the Compton scattering deal, actually, clear back even from the ending of chapter 3. And it would say that the oscillator, the electron, would radiate again at the same frequency as the incoming wave. These are wave fronts, and they move on through. But also this feels them and oscillates itself and then radiates at the same frequency. And that does happen, but you'll also see some radiation at a lower, longer wavelength or lower frequency. And so you have to postulate that it's a particle, a photon, rather than a smooth, continuous, extended wavefront like this. You have to imagine this particle coming in and conserving momentum and energy. This is redder than this picture because the wavelength here is longer than the wavelength here. And so, do we have data here? Yeah, well, I mean the formula. Here's a formula to show the change in the wavelength as a function of the angle theta. So the angle that you do this experiment at matters, but you do get a shift in the wavelength, and you see that in the data. Okay, this is chapter 4 now. This is all now review until we get up to section 4.6 in the book. So we've done all this. We know about electrons and positive charges in the nucleus. We talked about the 1897 plum pudding model of Thomson that looks like that. We saw that in the movie as well. And then Rutherford's scattering with the alpha particles. Just stop me if you have any questions. One in 2000.
Yeah, whenever they talk about the Compton shift, they're always talking about that, the change of the photon coming off. Is that correct?
Yeah, the new wavelength is a longer wavelength than the original wavelength. And that's, yeah, that's what we're always talking about. The calculation from Rutherford showed that the nucleus is about a 1/10,000th the size of the atom. So, you know, if you put a pea in the center of your football field, then representing the nucleus, then the electrons would be in their orbits and down out in the grandstands of the football stadium. It's about 10,000 times bigger. So 10 to the minus 14 of a meter is pretty small. So there's our symbol or model of the atom we've seen before. And let's see, before we talked about all this, there's the impact parameter and the stuff they all derived for the amount of scattering. Do a little bit of the computations here as well. Okay, so we're getting into the planetary model. The simple version is this, but it has problems, as we saw in our book, because it's supposed to spiral in as it accelerates and radiates and loses energy. And so Bohr comes along, and we've talked about these too, the assumptions. Could you mentally regurgitate what these assumptions are? I mean, maybe it would be worth looking at these hard enough to, I don't mean memorize them, commit them to memory in terms of rote memorization or brute force, but kind of think like Bohr thought and say, you know, what assumptions am I going to have to make in order to make this hydrogen model work out, given the problems with the classical model? So, you know, the stationary states, he postulated circular orbits at first. We eventually abandoned that later, too, but he has circular orbits, and they go around with angular momentum in those orbits, but the transitions between orbits aren't classical. Here's the little picture. When an electron jumps from a higher orbit to a lower orbit, or greater energy to smaller energy, it emits a photon whose energy corresponds to the gap between the two energy levels. And, of course, vice versa, it can also absorb a photon when it's jumping from a lower orbit to a higher orbit. Our book talks about two kinds of spectrum. Page 136, we have the absorption spectrum and the emission spectrum. Should have brought a transparency from the astronomy book. I'll try to remember next time. Showing both the absorption spectrum and the emission spectrum. In the diagram up above on figure 416, all the arrows are pointing down as if the electron is jumping from the higher orbit down to the lower orbit, and so that would be represented by a photon coming out that's equal to that energy difference. When the electrons jump up, that's absorption rather than emission. Now, the two spectra are not exactly identical. It kind of leads you to believe that they ought to be. It says right here, the sentence says, the missing frequencies are precisely the ones observed in the corresponding emission spectrum. That's cool. I mean, that means that same energy difference, whether you're absorbing or emitting, either way. The reason the two spectra aren't identical is that in most normal gases, the electrons like to normally be in their lowest energy state. So they can jump from there up to any other state, but they don't always jump back down to the lowest energy state necessarily. Sometimes if they're an excited n equals 5 state, they might jump down to 3 first for a while and then jump further down to n equals 1. So we have more lines in the emission spectrum than in the absorption spectrum. The frequencies are the same, except there's some extra ones, because when you're absorbing, you're almost always going from the bottom state being n equals 1 to some other state, whereas the reverse is not necessarily true. You might start in a higher energy level. You might jump all the way down to the lowest energy level, but you might not. You might jump to some intermediate level as well.
Question. I mean, it's sort of about some of the assumptions that he made. I mean, in the classical model, it said that if you have accelerating electrons, they give off energy.
Yes.
Why do people think that? I mean, what's the evidence for that, or why?
Well, Maxwell's equations say that they do. Maxwell's equations say that accelerating charges must radiate, and indeed we use that fact all the time. The way we make radio waves from your local radio station is to accelerate electrons up and down in the antenna, and they're going up and down, and they radiate at the right frequency. That means that for KMTI down here down the road, which broadcasts at 650 kilohertz, that the electrons are going up and down 650,000 times per second, but that's an acceleration. They're oscillating back and forth, and that's an acceleration, and they do radiate. So classically, this does happen, and we know it does. As to the second part of your question, how do we know they don't when you postulate the Bohr model of the hydrogen atom and just simply say, well, classical physics can't apply because they don't? Well, that answers its own question. They don't. Atoms do exist, and we don't see them fall apart as, let's see, let's go back here, in this simple picture here. It just, this doesn't happen. That is to say, atoms really do exist. Atoms are stable, and the electrons don't spiral down, emitting more and more violet and ultraviolet radiation as they spiral in. We don't see that, so atoms are stable.
But why wouldn't he have said, well, they must not be accelerating, they're just, I don't know, like a haze or a mist or something, because, I mean, how would, I don't know, I mean,
well, I like your haze or mist idea a lot, but that's still to come. We'll get to that when we talk about the wave nature of the electron. So that's very foresighted of you. That's good. But this was still mostly classical thinking in these days, and they didn't really understand that electrons acted like waves, and they thought they were still particles. And if you have a positively charged object in the center, the proton, the nucleus, and a negatively charged electron that's somewhere, you've got to come up with some scenario to keep them from flying together because they're mutually electrically attracted to each other. So it's, you know, just like the Earth is attracted to the Sun, if the Earth weren't orbiting the Sun, if you just stopped it and let it go, you know, just release it, it would go smacking into the Sun because of the gravitational attraction between the two. And the same would be true of an atom, a hydrogen atom. If you have a positively charged proton and a negatively charged electron that are just sitting there and you release them, they're attracted and they'll go smacking into each other. And so atoms wouldn't be stable under that scenario either. Now, just like we can maintain a stable solar system by having the planets orbit around, well, by analogy, I think there really was a lot of analogy going on in their mind here. They decided, well, maybe the electrons going around like a planet is, that allows the attractive force to be what keeps it in orbit so it doesn't fly off tangent in a straight line, but it also could be a stable system and not collapse. But so they liked the circular orbits because it was familiar, it was classical, it looked like planets, there was analogies to all of this, it sounded good. But then you do run into the issue that if it is in uniform circular motion, that it's accelerating and therefore ought to be radiating, but it isn't. So he said, he kind of forced into the corner. I mean, it does sound ad hoc, but I really don't see where else he could have gone. He was forced into the corner to say, I like these circular orbits, but it must mean that there's these special orbits where they don't radiate. It still goes around and it still accelerates. It still looks like a planet around the Sun. I know you don't like that, but I don't really see how he could have gotten around it any other way. Okay. Other questions, comments?
Just when you're talking about that, does that mean the Earth's radiating stuff or energy?
Because it's not charged too much. Normally, we consider the Earth to be neutral. The book talks about the correspondence principle. I think it's a philosophical point that's worth pointing out. It's important. Page 137 in the middle of the page, in the italics near the bottom, Bohr's correspondence principle. And it, I think it's a kind of a good rule of thumb. What we're saying here is that everything we knew and loved classically before the year 1900 didn't simply just all of a sudden stop working the minute we invented H, or the minute we invented the photoelectric, well, didn't invent, but explained the photoelectric effect. Just because we come up with a new theory to explain things doesn't mean that, you know, stuff you'd seen experimentally for decades all of a sudden wasn't true anymore. So, when you come up with this new, expansive, encompassing theory called quantum mechanics, correspondence principle applies. It says, in the limit, or where these two theories overlap and ought to make the same prediction, then quantum mechanics must reduce to the answer that we knew and loved for centuries. Quantum mechanic answer must reduce to the classical answer in those limits. And that's a nice correspondence principle. Correspond the quantum mechanics with the classical. That's kind of what this graphic's supposed to be pointing out.
Is this still a philosophy that scientists, physicists are comfortable with? Or, as we look at different things, or they're still trying to find their unified model, but people sort of philosophically follow this?
Well, I detected two questions in that. Yes, we are definitely still seeking a unified theory that explains everything. String theory is one approach to that, and we'll talk about that toward the end of the course. There are other ways to approach this unified theory that explains absolutely everything in one batch of equations. But this is a little bit different in that we're not claiming there has to be one underlying theory. We're actually claiming, in this case, Bohr's correspondence principle, that it has to reduce back to the old classical theory, which we actually know is wrong. I mean, when we go back to this picture right here, it says at the bottom, in the limits where classical and quantum theories should agree, then the quantum theory must reduce to the classical result. That's what we've just said, and I'm hoping that you like that because it's likable. But where they aren't supposed to agree, you know, where the first clause doesn't hold, quantum mechanics is right and classical physics is wrong. But that's in extreme cases, and that's in cases that we hadn't been able to experimentally test prior to 1900 for the most part. We were fat and happy with the classical results, but we hadn't looked at atoms, we hadn't looked at black holes, and we hadn't looked at, you know, non-classical situations. So the new theory is the more correct theory, and in fact the old one's wrong, but that doesn't mean that the old one is any more wrong than it ever really was. We just didn't know it was wrong because we hadn't tested it to its extreme limits back in the centuries before. So as long as you don't look in the extreme limits, the new theory must also agree with what we felt comfortable with classically the century before. Does that help make any sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's what I was, it's just like it's saying, it must reduce to the classical results. So if they, you know, find some wonderful way to string theory or whatever that explains everything, would it still reduce to the classical case, or sort of like a special case?
Yes.
Law of gravitation would still work in that little special case.
Yes.
Whatever.
Yes. It would still be true that the classical predictions would be a great approximation if you don't push it too far. You know, in the realms where classical physics should apply, that is to say, if it's not going too fast, so you don't have to worry about special relativity, or you're not looking at things that are too small, so you don't have to worry about quantum mechanics, or if you don't worry about too strong of gravity, so you don't have to worry about general relativity, then whatever theory you come up with does have to reduce back to the classical result, because the classical results really did work in those non-extreme cases. But in the extreme cases, it's wrong. Okay.
So, I mean, I guess that was my question. Physicists today, I mean, the most current people working on it, would still philosophically buy into that.
Yes. Yes, they would.
Somebody's going to throw it all away.
Right. And some of these new theories are very bizarre and very strange, even possibly more mind-boggling than some of the quantum mechanics will encounter. But, yeah, they'll still hold to the Bohr correspondence principle. Yeah. Okay, so there's some math there on the correspondence principle, but let's go to the failures. These are listed on page 141, so we've seen those already. Here are the x-rays. We see these x-rays. Here's the chart. The proper diagram for them is on page 141. The data is actually on page 143. That's kind of different to understand until you see the diagram first. What generates these x-rays if you bombard these poor little atoms? Well, Bohr's model suggests that we can talk about these electron shells. This picture, 418, is second nature to experienced physicists, but I always worry about what if you've never seen stuff like this before. So you need to understand, and I think we've seen some earlier diagrams similar to this, but when it says n equals 1 down here at the bottom, that is a circular orbit around the nucleus of the atom. This is the n equals 1 circular orbit Bohr model first energy level. So they flattened it out here to draw it as these straight horizontal lines representing the different energy levels. But you need to remember these are really circular orbits that don't look too circular here. But the way you get x-rays out of these Remember we talked about the emission spectrum of an electron jumping from a higher level down to a lower energy level, emitting a photon in the process has a certain energy. We saw visible light in the Balmer series. Let's see if I can go back and find a picture of that. It's right here. The Balmer series was jumping from higher orbits down to n equals 2. This is the Balmer series. So that might not be too common, as it might be to jump clear down to n equals 1, but we don't see those because that's a bigger gap, bigger energy difference. So that means more energetic photons coming out for the Lyman series. And if they're more energetic, that means a higher frequency or a shorter wavelength. So these would be ultraviolet lines that you can see with an ultraviolet detector, but you can't see them with your naked eye. These you can't. So how are you going to get X-rays, though? How are you going to have something jump down to actually produce X-rays out of this when this is barely in the ultraviolet and these are visible and these are infrared? Where are we going to get X-rays? Yes, but even if you go to the highest possible n, which is the infinitieth n, and the energy is zero down to 13.6, the whole gap, I'm on page 136 if you want to see this better in your book, but clear from the top level, which is close to ionization, all the way down to the n equals 1 level, the whole gap there is only 13.6 electron volts, which is ultraviolet, but not X-ray. And so there are no ends above the ionization level. I mean, that's you've separated the electron all the way off of the atom, and they're not even together anymore, not bound. So the most you can get out of a hydrogen atom is 13.6 electron volt photons. It's the most energetic.
And you've got to use a different atom.
Yes, that's the correct answer. So you use a high Z atom. Does it say what they're going to use?
Heavy one.
Heavy atoms, whatever ones. High Z atoms are going to bind those electrons much more tightly, which means that there's more energy bound up in that. So if something jumps from a high level down to a lower level in one of these bigger atoms, it's much more than 13.6 volts as they radiate their energy. That's where these X-rays are coming from. What you do is blast out an electron from a lower energy level. Now, in the old days, we called this N equals 1. That's what came from the previous diagram. Now we call it the K shell. That means the same thing. This is the N equals 2. We call it the L shell, K, L, M, N, O. Those letters in the alphabet are the names of these shells. It's historical. It's probably redundant. We probably don't really need both sets of nomenclature, but we're kind of stuck with it. So the if you can blast out somehow an electron out of the K shell, hit it really hard and smack it completely out of the atom, there's now a slot there that's empty waiting to be filled. Remember, these are big atoms, heavy atoms, high Z atoms, so they don't just have one electron like the hydrogen atom did. They have many electrons stacked up in these various energy levels, different shells. So when there's an opening down in the bottom shell, they're going to jump on it, and so they will jump from a higher level down to a lower level and give off the amount of energy that corresponds to that energy gap between the two shells. Because it's a high Z, which holds tightly onto these electrons, those gaps can be large in energy and emit X-ray photons. What this means is there are characteristic X-ray spectra of these atoms. If you get these higher energy atoms and you smack them hard so you knock out an interior electron, the X-rays that come out have specific wavelengths or specific frequencies, and you can detect those, and it's a way of identifying the chemical element that you had there to start with. Okay? No, we don't know. Say you create a vacancy in the K shell. We don't know whether it will jump down from the L shell to the K shell, or from the M shell down to the K shell, or from the N shell. We don't know which one is going to do that. We can't predict that. There's probabilities, but what you do get is you're never going to do this experiment on one atom at a time. You always have a bulk amount of material. And so this is going on whole bunches of atoms at a time, and you get gobs of X-rays out, but a bunch of them will be at that energy gap. A bunch more of them will be, you know, a different bunch of them will be the M down to the K. And so you'll get peaks or spikes in your X-ray spectra that correspond to those particular gaps. And you can mark those wavelengths and then identify which atom. This is a way of identifying unknown chemical samples with this X-ray spectra. We actually saw this clear back in chapter, where was it? I'm trying to remember where we... I told you to pay attention to this for a future chapter. It was in chapter 3, I think. Do you remember this picture? We talked about the Bremsstrahlung process as making this kind of smooth background X-ray spectrum. And I said the spikes come from something else, which we'll talk about in chapter 4. Well, that's it. Now you know what the spikes are. It's these. And in fact, it refers you back here on page 105 to figure 317 right there. It does refer back. There it talks about 317. So yes, we know how to predict these wavelengths. The frequencies are right here. And you can adjust it for other jumps and gaps. Other questions about these X-ray spectra? There's one more experiment I want to talk about. Study up photoelectric effect, the Bremsstrahlung process, the Compton effect, Bohr's assumptions of the Bohr model, the hydrogen atom, the X-ray spectra that we just talked about 1 minute ago, the limitations of the Bohr model, and then the last question is about this new stuff. So it's a really good kind of overall quiz for the whole chapter, and even a tiny bit back in chapter 3 with the Compton effect. So I'll give that quiz to you next time.
Could you explain that chart? Graph on page 143.
We'll give it a try.
What I don't understand, why are there like three or four different lines kind of in each section? I mean, what's... Yeah.
All right, that I think I can help you with. To answer that question, I'm going to refer back to figure 418. And when the electrons, to fill the vacancy, jump from the L shell down to the K shell, that's called the K sub alpha line in the spectrum. It's just more Greek letters all over again. It's just, I don't know. They could have invented a different nomenclature. But from 2 to 1 is the alpha. From the M shell down to the K shell, or that is from the N equals 3 down to the N equals 1, that gives you the K sub beta line. That is to say, you're ending up in the K shell. That's what the K is for. But the beta tells you you started two shells above that. And the K, gamma, et cetera, delta, epsilon, for these higher shells. That's what you're seeing here on this page 143. You have the K series line here. All these belong to the K. So these are all jumping down to the K shell. This is the ones that are jumping from the N equals 2 L shell. And the K beta line is this shorter one here. These are the electrons that are jumping from the M shell down 2 to the K shell. So up here you see more. This is the L series, which means that these electrons are now jumping from higher shells, even still, like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, down to the L shell, which is N equals 2. So there's the ones that are jumping from the M shell, which is 1 above L. Alpha means 1 above, down to the L. And do they have any others labeled? Next one would be the L sub beta. The next one would be the L sub gamma. And that's why there's a bunch of those lines there. Does that help?
They should each have 4 or 5, but maybe they just didn't put them.
I'm not sure why they peter out on these K. They've only got 2 down here. I don't know why there's not more data here. They also note in the caption, though, that there's missing Z43, 61, and 75. So you look over here and you see that 43 was, what element is that, technetium or something? They hadn't discovered it yet. And 61 the same way, hadn't discovered it yet. So you go across right there, and there's no data right there. And you go across the 43, and there's no data right there either. The same over here on the K series.
That answered my question, I think.
Okay. Here's the new experimental setup for the Frank Hertz experiment. Let's see if I have a picture of this. Oh, we do. Let's go back to the computer. I think it's a little clearer. It's the same picture. This is the Frank Hertz experiment. What were they trying to prove with this thing? They were trying to say, we've seen quantization with photons. We know about the photoelectric effect. We've seen that energy is quantized in these line spectra. We believe in photon energy quantization. But let's do an experiment to demonstrate that even particles, like electrons, also have their energy quantized. And so they were going to hope to see quantization out of this experiment here. They're going to boil off electrons off the filament, accelerate them with an electric field, this voltage between the filament and the grid accelerates the electrons from left to right, and then when they pass the grid, they're going to smack into the collector. They talk about this where after passing through the grid, the electrons feel the effects of a decelerating voltage. So from here to here, the electrons are accelerating, and then they pass the grid. Notice how it's hooked up electrically here, that there's now a decelerating voltage of 1.5 volts or something from here to here. So they're slowing down. And if they didn't have enough energy to begin with, they won't even make it to the collector. So the greater the voltage here, the more electrons you expect to see on the collector. In other words, if you draw a graph of current versus voltage, the greater the voltage, the more acceleration you put on these electrons, the more of them you would expect to hit the collector and make a current go through the ammeter here and measure as part of your collector current. So you'd expect it to be kind of a direct relationship, more voltage, more current. But interesting things happen, and that takes us to this picture. You actually do see, for the first little while down here, kind of, I mean, it almost looks a little bit flat, but for a while, the more voltage you put on, the greater the collector current is. This is in nanoamperes and volts, so it's a small amount of current, but it's increasing. But then all of a sudden, when you get just past 5 volts, all of a sudden there's a dip here, and you might say to yourself, why is there this dip at all? And again, especially, why would there be other future dips seemingly equally spaced in voltage along here, the drops here are about equally spaced. Why would that be? How can we explain this? We would expect that the more voltage we put on, the more current we get to the collector. And yet here, right here, the first time we see this, we've increased the voltage, and all of a sudden there's a decrease in the collector current. Just keep referring back to this setup to see why that might be startling. What's the explanation? Why do we see a sudden drop in the current right above 5 volts? There's gas in the tube. I mean, we need to have said that. There's mercury vapor sitting around in this tube here. Does that help?
Well, aren't you giving the electrons exactly the right amount of energy to hook up with the mercury?
Yes. At first they thought that they were ionizing the mercury, and that's where the energy was going, but then they realized that it was the first excited state of the mercury atoms. It's just about 5 volts, 4.88 electron volts in energy is the first excited state of mercury. So what these electrons were doing as they come zipping down here is they get a lot of energy. If they have more than above 5 electron volts of energy and they hit one of these mercury atoms, it can impart some of its energy, some of its kinetic energy, directly to the mercury atom and make its electron jump up from the lowest state to the first excited state. That's what's going on. This jump right here is because these cruising electrons have enough energy to bump up the mercury atoms to their first excited state, which is 4.88 eV of energy.
So does this whole tube glow in different colors?
As the mercury relaxes and the electron jumps back down, then yeah, it would emit a photon of energy 4.88 eV. I don't know off the top of my head if 4.88 eV is still in the visible spectrum or not. It's a little high. Might not be visible. It might be ultraviolet, but we could do the calculation and find out easy enough if it were visible. But I guess in a sense it would glow ultraviolet if we couldn't see it. At 4.88 eV, that's what would be given off by the excited mercury atoms relaxing back to the ground state.
So did all of these scientists get sunburned?
From the ultraviolet? I don't know. We're not talking about a lot of stuff here. This is nanoamperes of current on the collector, so probably not. The next big question, though, now we've understood the first drop here is, why is there another drop? And why are there successive drops spaced by about the same amount? Marty?
I don't know. I was just going to ask you.
I took the words right out of your mouth.
Does it take the same energy?
They're spaced by 4.88 eV each drop. Are they exciting the mercury atoms up to maybe the N equals 3 or N equals 4 state? Is that a possibility? Well, that might be a first guess, except they're not going to have the same excited state energy levels. The gap isn't going to be 4.88 eV anymore. So it's not that you're smacking them and knocking the electron up to a even more excited state, above the first excited state. That's not the answer, although it might be the first thing you thought of. What happens is, if you accelerate those electrons so fast, they're zipping across here now, they whack into one mercury atom, knock it into its excited state. If they still have enough energy left over after that first collision, they've lost energy in that first collision, but they still have enough, they collide with a second mercury atom, they can knock it into its first excited state, too. That's the answer to all these little dips, is successively more collisions with other mercury atoms. It explains this on page 146. We can explain the experimental results of Frank Hertz quite easily within the context of Bohr's quantized atomic energy levels. The first quantized state existing above the ground state is at an excitation energy of 4.88 eV. As long as the accelerating electron's kinetic energy is below that, no energy is transferred because there's not enough available to excite it to the next energy level. You can't excite it to a halfway in between energy level, so it's got to have enough or it doesn't happen at all. The mercury atom is so much more massive than the electron that almost no kinetic energy is transferred to the recoil, so the collision's elastic. The electron can only bounce off the mercury atom and continue along a new path with about the same kinetic energy because it was an elastic collision. If the electron gains at least 4.88 eV of kinetic energy, it can transfer it to an atom, a mercury atom, promoting it to the first excited state. However, in this case, the electron loses energy, and we call those inelastic collisions, when it loses kinetic energy. An electron that has lost energy in an inelastic collision then has too little energy to reach the collector. That is why the current drops. After it's gone through an inelastic collision and lost a bunch of energy, by promotion of a mercury atom to its excited state, the electron no longer has enough energy to reach the collector, so the current has dropped. Then they go through to explain the fact that it could hit twice, but the successive peaks show that it's multiple collisions. The last part of that paragraph, though, the third to the last one, middle of that, says the first peak does not occur at 4.88 eV. That is, look at the graph on the screen. It's a little above 5, not right at 4.88. And that's because the first peak does not appear there because the difference in the work functions between the dissimilar metals used as the cathode and the anode. So that's why they're all shifted over a little bit, because of the work function. But then they're spaced equally by 4.88 eV. This experiment, what's its purpose or its point, the summary thing? Convincingly prove the quantization of atomic electron energy levels. The bombarding electron's kinetic energy can change only by certain discrete amounts. So, to wrap up, we've seen that with incoming photons, it can deposit energy into an atom and promote it to excited states. It has just the right amount of energy that corresponds to one of those gaps. It does so. But now we've also seen that electrons can also deposit energy in quantized amounts as well. Only the absorbing electron can take specific amounts, and that's an inelastic collision, and otherwise it doesn't lose any at all, so it's a quantization effect. Time's up. Any concluding remarks? And keep turning in homework, keep sloshing through it. We're basically done with Chapter 4.